Welcome, lucky listeners. Grab yourselves a hot cup of... Tuck yourself down deep into the covers and make sure the lights are on. It's time for Read Me a Nightmare.
Welcome to episode 41 of Read Me a Nightmare. I'm Angelique Fons, your host, and today we have a special guest. Shannon Fox is one of my favorite writing buddies, and we both recently come back from Superstars. If you want to learn more about this amazing opportunity to level up your writing career, you'll want to hang in and listen to our epiphanies. Shannon also shares her near-death experience, and we get into the weeds about trad publishing versus indie. But first, let's listen to her tale of curiosities in an antique shop. I bought it for my Cursed and Creepy anthology as a reprint, and it was originally published in September 2019 in the anthology Cursed Collectibles. Shannon is not only a writer, but also the owner of Minute Marketing, a marketing company based in San Diego, California, that helps realtors and other housing industry professionals save time with their marketing. Our voice actor today is Karen Chute, and she's a regular reader here at Read Me a Nightmare. You can learn more about her at www.fonz.ca on our podcast tab. Now let's jump into the story. I hope you enjoy The Garden Party.
The Garden Party by Shannon Fox. A stone angel clutched a laminated placard between its fingers. 50% off, everything on sale. Moisture had smeared the corner of the red ink. "Let's go in," Charlie said. He pulled Katie by the hand towards the entrance of the store. She dug in her heels when she saw what kind of store it was and rolled her eyes at her boyfriend.
"Really, babe? Another antique store?
Just for a minute. Just look." "No," Katie said. "I told you I wanted to go home. My feet hurt from walking. I'm sunburned, and I've got sand all over me." "You're the one who wanted to go to the beach," Charlie said. He looked her up and down with a smirk. "To get a tan." Her blood pounded in her ears as she felt the judgment leaching into his words. "Pale people don't tan, so why did you even bother trying?" She wanted to smack the smug look from his perfectly bronzed face. Charlie let go of her hand and took a step towards the store. "Stay here if you want, but I'm going in." She watched the door shut behind him and contemplated storming off towards the car. She wondered if he'd chase after her, or if he'd even noticed she'd moved from the sidewalk outside. Katie looked at the sign in the window as she pushed open the door. A.R. Greed. She was sure Charlie was in hog heaven to be browsing a store with a snooty name like that. Dusty armoires and curio cabinets cluttered the floor, their shelves crowded with curiosities. Paintings of all styles and sizes clung to the walls like fungus. What couldn't be hung up was simply leaned against wrought iron tables and rolled up oriental rugs. Statues jockeyed for the last remaining bits of floor space. Katie wrinkled her nose at the musty odor. She hated that smell. It was the scent of too many afternoons wasted, while Charlie haggled over a lamp or an old book. As she made her way deeper into the store, she was careful not to touch anything. She knew firsthand how serious these shopkeepers were about their you-break-it-you-buy-it policy. With her student loans, she didn't have any extra pocket money to spend on this place. A group of small, white porcelain figurines lined up on a table caught her eye. Her grandmother had owned something similar. She'd actually left the collection to Katie, but Katie had given it to her little sister. At the time, she hadn't had any use for miniature kittens and puppies with dopey smiles on their faces. Now, though, she wondered if perhaps she should have kept one to remember her grandmother by. As Katie reached for the tiny white horse in the corner, a disembodied voice startled her. "Is there something I can help you find?" Katie looked to her right and spotted a man seated in a red velvet armchair. She hadn't noticed him as she'd walked up, probably because he looked like one of the antiques himself. Though the thick bush of white hair adorning his head revealed his age, his blue eyes were sharp, and his face was curiously free of wrinkles. His skin had the unnaturally smooth look of a shirt that had just been ironed. "I'm just looking," Katie said, hoping he would go away. She didn't like the way he was looking at her, as if she were a chocolate he wanted to pluck from the box. She needed to find Charlie and get out of here. As if he'd been summoned, her boyfriend rounded the corner with a canvas in his hands. "This painting is incredible. Who painted this?" Charlie turned the canvas around so the shopkeeper could see it. In her opinion, it looked like a passable attempt at recreating a puddle of spilled spaghetti sauce. The shopkeeper stood. "That was done by one of our local artists. I can find the name if you'd like." "Please," said Charlie. When they were alone, Katie grabbed Charlie's sleeve. "Can we go? I'm tired." He shook her off without glancing at her. The painting had his complete attention. Just a couple more minutes.
"Oh, I think I got too much sun today," Katie said. "I should lie down. Please, let's go home."
Charlie sighed. He set the painting down and turned to her with narrowed eyes.
"You always want to leave."
"Not always," she protested.
"I never complain when you make me go to the mall with you to purchase yet another lipstick that you're just going to lose in the bottom of your purse."
"When was the last time we even went to the mall? We've been to 4 antique stores this weekend alone."
"I haven't found what I'm looking for yet."
Katie folded her arms over her chest.
"And what's that?"
He threw up his hands.
"You wouldn't understand."
"I wouldn't? Do you even know what you want?
Where does it end, Charlie?
With us spending every weekend arguing in antique stores over and over again until one of us gives up or dies?"
Charlie pointed a finger at her.
"You always turn it into a fight."
"You never listen to what I want."
"Because you don't compromise. If you just let me have 5 minutes to look around."
"We've been here longer than that, at least 10 minutes.
"Because you're distracting me, Katie. How am I supposed to take a good look around with you constantly whining and pulling at my sleeve?"
Katie gritted her teeth.
"I do not whine."
Excuse me?
The shopkeeper smiled politely at them. "The name of that artist is Timothy Pollard."
Charlie nodded, as if he knew exactly who that was.
Katie rolled her eyes. The shopkeeper took a step towards her. "You didn't seem very impressed with the painting, so I thought you might like this instead." She heard Charlie gasp as the old man turned the object he was holding in his hands to face her. It was an antique silver mirror. The filigreed handle was tarnished in places, and the surface of the glass was spotted with age. But worse than the imperfections of the piece was the face staring back at her in the mirror. To her horror, Katie now saw that a bloom of pink colored her cheeks and nose. Her freckles, which she tried to keep concealed under layers of carefully applied makeup, had multiplied exponentially in the sun. Strands of blonde hair hung limply around her face like greasy noodles. Katie tore her gaze away from the mirror. She had to get home before someone she knew saw her like this.
"Charlie, we're leaving."
She tried her best to sound assertive, as if her words brooked no argument. But Charlie either didn't hear or didn't care. In his hands, he now held a ceramic elephant. About the size of a grapefruit, it was stylized and covered in a mosaic of colorful tiles. She knew why it had caught his eye. Charlie used to have a similar one, until Katie had knocked it over on their first anniversary, and its destruction had seriously brought into question whether they would see another year.
"How much is this?"
Charlie asked, turning to the shopkeeper.
"I'm afraid that one's not for sale."
"How much, though? $100? $200?
"I'm sorry, but it isn't for sale."
$250?
"Let's go, Charlie," Katie said. She raised her voice.
"I mean it. It's me or that stupid elephant." But her boyfriend continued to ignore her and took a step towards the shopkeeper.
"Come on, everything's for sale for the right price. Just give me a number. I'm not leaving without it."
A cloud of dark smoke suddenly stung Katie's eyes and made them water. She squeezed them shut and coughed as the smoke tickled her throat. When she opened them again, the smoke had cleared and she was alone with the shopkeeper. Charlie was nowhere to be seen. On the carpet, the ceramic elephant lay on its side.
"Charlie?"
She looked around but didn't see him anywhere. She hadn't closed her eyes for long.
How could he have moved that fast?
The shopkeeper stooped to pick up the elephant from the carpet. It seemed to shimmer as he laid his hands on it. A trick of the light, perhaps.
Did you see where my boyfriend went?"
The old man shrugged. "You said you wanted to leave. Now you're free to go." Katie blinked.
"You didn't answer my question."
"Didn't I, though?"
"Where's Charlie?"
She hated how her voice quivered as she said his name. In response, the man turned and walked away from her, heading deeper into the store.
"Hey!"
Katie yelled as she followed him.
"I was talking to you!"
The shopkeeper glanced over his shoulder at her, but did not stop until he was standing in front of an enormous curio cabinet. He unlatched the doors, and Katie could see that there was an empty space on the top shelf, just wide enough to accommodate a ceramic elephant. "What do you want with this man, anyway?" the shopkeeper asked as he slid the elephant onto the shelf where it belonged. "There are other better specimens." The elephant glittered in the late afternoon sun. "Other better specimen?" Katie asked. "What happened to Charlie?" There was a twinkle in the shopkeeper's eye as he smiled. "I think you know what happened to Charlie." She looked from the cabinet to the man and back again, a pit of dread growing in her stomach. "What have you done? You gave him a choice. He chose." "He's not..."
"Dead?"
"No, not dead. Suspended, like a mosquito in amber."
"But he's inside that elephant."
"His soul is." Her pulse pounded in her ears, and she felt dizzy. She wanted to believe the man was lying to her, that his mind was simply addled by age. But what other explanation was there? One moment Charlie was there, demanding the man give him a price for the elephant. And then, with a puff of smoke, he was gone.
"He didn't deserve this," she said.
"Not at all." The man looked annoyed. "You're deceiving yourself, Katie. You were there. You told him to choose you or the elephant. I'm sure that wasn't the first time you've felt as if your own existence paled in comparison to the latest trinket or artifact he happened to stumble upon. No, I'm sure this has happened many times before." He was right. Katie knew he was right. But she loved Charlie with everything that she was.
"Give him back."
She felt her hands curl into fists at her side, but forced herself to relax. Attacking the old man wasn't going to make him any more inclined to help her, and she needed his help to get Charlie back. "I'm afraid I can't. I never intended for it to be reversible." His tone was so certain, so final that she knew he wasn't lying. Katie stared at the Charlie elephant in the curio cabinet as tears blurred her vision. What was she going to do now? She couldn't just leave him here. All alone, sandwiched between a gilded tiger and a monkey in a fez hat? Her eyes kept moving along the shelf, taking in the crocodile with its yawning jaws, the parrot with ruby eyes, and on and on. She gasped.
"They're not all of them?"
The man gave a curt nod. "But don't mistake them for people who deserve your sympathy. Every one of them stumbled in here blinded by their greed and quite willingly walked into the trap I laid." She thought she might be sick as her eyes roamed around the antique store, taking in the sheer number of figurines packed onto shelves. "There must have been hundreds of them." "It's not just the statues," the man said. "Everything you see in this store is enchanted." Katie put out a hand to steady herself as the blood roared in her ears. "Hundreds upon hundreds of people just like Charlie."
"Everything? How could you do this to them?"
"Imagine a garden party, Katie. One with plates of finger sandwiches, fresh fruit, colorful macaroons, and pitcher after pitcher of iced tea. A lovely event that can only be ruined by one thing," the man said. "The inevitable arrival of a cloud of buzzing flies. You can't stop it from happening. Unless, perhaps, you catch them first. I find a jar of honey to be quite suitable for such an occasion."
"Is that how you describe it? Catching flies with honey? Those are people in there."
She took a breath, for courage. "And I suppose I'm next." He shook his head. "No, Katie. You're free to go." She stared at him, searching his face to see if he was joking.
"Free to go? Why not me?" she asked.
"Why not you?"
"Because you're a guest at the garden party, Katie."
She squeezed her eyes shut. They'd been planning their wedding. Charlie had told her he was shopping for the perfect ring. She'd begged him to buy her something modern, not anything that came from a glass case in an antique store. They'd fought over it, but in the end, she'd won that round. After all, if she was going to have to stare at the ring every day for the rest of her life, it needed to be something she liked. They had vacationed with each other's families. They shared a bank account. They'd been looking at condos together. They were planning to get a puppy in the fall. Everything was going according to plan. And yet, now she was free to go. Free to walk back into a different life. A life without Charlie, yes, but loving Charlie had never been easy. She had always come second to whatever item he'd toted home from the flea market. The brass candlesticks, the first editions, the porcelain figurines, all of it capable of eliciting more affection from him than she ever had. She remembered the stinging slap he'd dealt her after she'd broken his elephant. She could almost feel the way his hand had closed around her wrist, squeezing until she thought he would snap it. The wild look he'd had in his eyes as he'd yelled at her and called her all kinds of vile things. When he kissed her, those words still returned again and again to her mind, no matter how hard she tried to forget them. A few tears slipped down her cheeks, stinging her sunburned skin. As she wiped them away, she suddenly thought of Morocco, a place she'd wanted to visit for years. But Charlie had always said no, had always said traveling outside the country cost too much. Katie blinked her tears away and promised herself she would go. She would see the markets of Marrakesh, visit a sultan's palace, ride a camel through the desert, do all of the things she'd always wanted to do now that she had no one to tell her no. "Do not misunderstand me," the man continued. "You're certainly flawed. You're vain and at times selfish. But you're not disposed to greed, not as he was." Is greedy really the worst thing a person can be? And who are you to judge? She watched the shopkeeper's face as he considered her words. He suddenly looked very, very tired, and she wondered how old he was, and what he was. "I have walked this earth for a long time, longer than you can fathom. Greed brings war. It tears people apart. It causes love to wither on the vine. Perhaps greed is not the worst of all sins, but it is among the most destructive. As for who I am, it is irrelevant. It does not change his fate." She took a breath. "I don't understand why you'd let me go, after everything I've seen here today." He shook his head. "Once you walk out that door, you will never return. This place won't open for you. It was intended for Charlie." "But I walked in on my own." "You were accidentally caught up in the enchantment, like one of those fishing nets you humans are so fond of using. Now I'm releasing you. So go home, Katie." She hesitated, just for a moment. Then she pointed to the Charlie elephant. "Not without him." "I can't let you do that." Katie crossed her arms over her chest. "You can, and you will." Amusement glittered in his eyes. "Are you threatening me?" Her insides turned to ice at his words, but she fought to keep her voice steady as she replied. "Not a threat. You said it yourself. What's done cannot be undone. So it won't matter if he stays here with you or goes with me." The man rubbed his chin. "It has never been done before. I don't know if his soul will continue to live on if you take him from this place." "Then I would be doing him an even greater kindness." The man studied her for a long moment, appraising her like one of his antiques. Katie forced herself to meet his gaze, though her skin crawled from his attention. After a long moment, he nodded. "You are the first person who has ever been unintentionally caught in my trap. So I suppose it's only fitting that you will be the first person to ever remove an object from my store. If you understand the risk to Charlie and wish to proceed anyway, I will let you take him with you." She nodded. "I have to believe he truly loved me, and that he would do the same if our roles were reversed." The shopkeeper unlocked the curio cabinet and picked up the elephant. He stroked its trunk for a moment before placing it in her outstretched hands and gently folding her fingers around it. "It is not my place to speculate on human relationships," the man said, "but I agree he loved you, as he loved all the objects he possessed." With that, Katie suddenly felt a crushing pressure in her skull, as the man and the shop around him twisted, blurred, and disappeared. She found herself standing on the sidewalk out front, facing an empty storefront with the elephant in her hands. It was still late afternoon, and the sunlight reflecting off the mosaic of tiles that formed the elephant's hide momentarily blinded her. She blinked against the glare and slipped the elephant in her pocket. The statue of the stone angel still stood out front. Its hands, now empty of the laminated placard, beckoned to her. The shopkeeper had said that everything inside the store was enchanted. She'd taken that to mean that the statue outside was just a normal statue. But as she stared at the orphan statue of the angel, she felt a shiver run down her spine and walked quickly away. Perhaps it wasn't enchanted as the others were, but there was still something unnatural about it. On the way back to the car, a window display caught her eye. The TV screen inside displayed the words, "Nobody loves you like you do," in bright rainbow colors. She'd never noticed this store before. Perhaps it was new. Katie watched the TV until the words faded out and were replaced with the brand's logo, Vanity Outfitters. Katie felt as if she had been plunged in ice water. She glanced down the street towards where the antique store had been. Could it be? She closed her fingers around the elephant in her pocket and turned away from the window.
I hope you enjoyed The Garden Party as much as I did. You can find it in Cursed and Creepy, a horror light anthology, published by myself, Angelique Fons, including some of my stories and some from my friends like Shannon. We are creating an audiobook with all of the stories, and that should be coming to market soon. But if you can't wait for the audiobook, you can go to www.fons.ca and learn how to get a copy right away of the print book or ebook. Now let's chat with Shannon. So I'm here today, everyone, with Shannon Fox, and you just listened to her story, The Garden Party, which is part of Cursed and Creepy. Shannon, tell me what your inspiration for the story was.
So this story, I actually wrote a very long time ago. I actually wrote it way back in college. And it must have been around like 2010, because I was with my ex-boyfriend at the time. And we were in La Jolla in San Diego. And if you've never been there, it's very upscale town with lots and lots of like art galleries and boutiques and restaurants and just very expensive stuff that are very out of reach for the average college student's bank account, even though La Jolla is literally the town that the college we went to, UCSD, UC San Diego, is in technically. And we went down there. I don't remember what we were doing, but we were just walking around and we went into an antique store. And I remember we were walking around. All of a sudden I came around the corner and the owner's just like, "Hello." We're just chilling in the corner. And I was just like, yeah, so a lot of the experience of my memories from that day is in that story. I mean, my boyfriend didn't get put into an you know, little creepy ceramic elephant there. Is that a spoiler? Should I not spoil it?
They would have just heard it, not a spoiler, but yes. Wouldn't that's true. I like to sometimes put our significant others into little ceramic elephants.
Yeah. And so a lot of, so much of that story is based off of just that experience. Like, yeah, I mean, just even the age of the characters too. So yeah. And I wrote it for a creative writing class, turned it in, probably got an A. I don't really remember. And then it sat in my drawer for a long time while I was trying to decide if I wanted to be like a literary writer. Cause I went to, UC San Diego has an MFA program. I didn't go to that. I just did the undergrad writing, but they are more experimental and literary. And so that was kind of what I got trained on. And so for many years after college, I was trying to decide what I wanted to be. And then I made actually one of my neighbors is a writer and convinced me to go to Superstars writing seminars, which kind of reignited my love for genre, which never really faded. I actually pulled that story out for like an open anthology call and ended up rewriting it around like 2018 or so. And then that story actually, so the original anthology it was in is the Curse Collectibles anthology. And I would say that that story is probably my most read story, which is really interesting because it's one of the earliest stories that I have in publication. But if people own an anthology I'm in, it's usually that one. So hopefully now they'll own yours and they'll continue to make this my most read story.
Isn't that something that I bet just about something to do with the genuineness of it? I find that my most appreciated story or the one that people say they like the most was one of the first ones I wrote, which was Death Metal Fan. I think sometimes when you're just writing without thinking of craft and you have an inspiration from real life, what comes out is often so real that people are attracted to it. Whereas,
yeah, I would agree with you. I feel like usually some of my successful stories have an element of something from real life in them, whether a lot of times it's like a real life experience. Another of my early stories that I got published was a very sad story that was based off of a story that someone told me. And then I took that, you know, what was described to me as a modern day experience, and I put it into historical fiction. I also did that one when I was in college as well. But that one was also one of the ones that got published early on. And I still think that is really a pretty good story. And it is, you know, I think because it also, you know, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
So you mentioned Superstars.
Yes.
So this is Shannon and I have just come back from Superstars, from anybody who's listening. And it was frankly mind-blowing for me. I feel like I went to Superstars thinking I was going in one direction. And then I've come out of Superstars going in a completely different direction.
Oh, I'm really interested to hear what that is.
Oh, okay. Well, first I'll tell you, but first I want to find out, when did you first go? What was your introduction to it? Like, when did you first start?
So I went to Superstars in 2018, as I mentioned. So my husband and I rented the same house in San Diego for, I think it's 10 years this year, which is a really long time to stay anywhere, but we live on the best street in the world. I will fight you for that because we have the best neighbors. And one of the reasons we have the best neighbors is one of my neighbors is a writer, is actually one of my best writer friends, my best critique partner. And at the time, pre-children, she was a regular attendee of Superstars. And I had known for a couple of years that she went to this really cool conference and she really enjoyed it. And she convinced me to go with her. So I went 2018, and it was a really cool experience for me because it was also the same year I was starting my business and about to leave my job and become an entrepreneur. So I felt very like on the crossroads of like this thing. And then also like, you know, I had been writing probably all my life, honestly. And consistently, I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, I stopped writing for 20 years and I came back to it. No, I never have stopped. I've written my whole life, wanted to be published. I mean, I was querying author or agents with some sort of book. I don't even remember what it was, but back in like 2008, when I was 18 and starting college.
Good for you.
And so I've been very like on this path for a long time. And just, you know, at that stage of 2018, that was 10 years after I went to college and I had started querying agents, and I was like, I want something to happen. I don't know what it is. And, you know, clearly, as we all know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing. Right. And so I was like, well, let's do something different. Let's go to this conference. And she says, it's great. And I went, and like you, I thought I was doing one thing and I left doing something else. And then really where that has evolved, I think it was definitely a turning point for me. In my writing, for sure, like I look at my writing development as like pre and post 2018. Really, 2018 is a very significant year also because of the starting of the business, leaving the job, becoming an entrepreneur. But also my writing really turned and became a lot more what it is today.
Which is what?
Better.
Better.
Better. I stopped trying to do the literary thing. I started actually writing genre and the things that I cared about. So I write a lot of historical fantasy. I write contemporary fantasy and I write science fiction. I think my writing has objectively gotten better. I've had a lot more publications. I finished a lot more books and had more success querying them, notwithstanding the one that I'm querying right now, which is going terrible, but it's fine.
So are the other books published yet, or are they?
No, they're in the drawer. So most of the books are in the drawer because I have really wanted to be agented and really wanted to pursue that traditional path for a very long time. And it's only really in the last 6 months of feeling like, you know, like, and I think there's always a consideration when you want that path to being like, okay, well, if I self-publish the book, I'm effectively taking it out of consideration for this in the future, because then you're always running against that question of like, well, maybe it's not just not a right now book. Maybe if I query it again in 5 years, it'll be different, or I edit it, whatever. But I had a very scary experience in the fall where I legitimately thought I was going to die on our honeymoon, and a very scary experience in the ocean. And I remember really feeling like this might be it. Like this might be the end moments of my life. And they weren't, spoiler alert.
So what happened? Shim's here with us today. So what happened? Like you got in a...
So we were out on a snorkeling tour, and I learned later. So one of my really good friends is a marine biologist, and snorkels, scubas, is in the water a lot. And she said that what can happen sometimes when waves pick up is they start breaking further back from shore than they normally do because they're rising in height. So that's kind of the background context. So basically we're on this snorkel tour and we're getting ready to come in, and we're in Hawaii, and our guide was basically like, okay, we're going to go in an organized fashion. Cause where we were was this place called like Electric Beach, which I think is actually not a scary place to snorkel. So if you're going to, Oahu, it's very nice. Lots of locals go there. It was just a bad luck kind of scenario. And, basically what it is there's a cliff on one side, and on the other side, there's a seawall because there used to be an electric power plant there, which is why it's called Electric Beach. And the pipes are still there, so they're warm under the water. So you get lots of sea life that are, you know, coming around. So good place to snorkel. So your entry and exit point is not like a super narrow, like beachy area, but kind of narrow. And so anyway, our guide was like, okay, we're going to go in like an organized fashion. So everyone kind of like group up with me by the buoy, and then, you know, we'll go in like pairs or whatever. And I am nothing if not someone who follows instructions. And so I go over to our guy and I'm like, okay, great. I'm the first one to the buoy. Like, awesome. Like I survived the snorkeling thing. This is great. I had a good time. We saw some turtles, day one of honeymoon, like in the bath. And I'm with him and we're waiting for the rest of the group to come in. And then all of a sudden, like, and so I'm with him, right? And we're kind of waiting. And I kind of, and I half turn and I look and I'm like, oh shit, there is a wave right there. And he sees it the same time that I do. And this massive wave breaks on us. And when that happens, it shoves us, not where we were facing the beach, but about 15 feet to the left, facing the damn seawall. And what happens is that wasn't the first wave. That was the first of a series of waves that are now going to turn us like clothes on a washing machine. And as I'm thinking, like, what, as I'm imagining this experience, and I'm like, what is happening? And I'm trying to get out of this situation. I'm realizing that seawall is not only made of concrete, it is covered in rocks. It is also covered in barnacles. And this wave is extremely strong. And I'm thinking, I'm wearing a life vest, which is awesome, but I'm not wearing a helmet. And I'm thinking about what happens when the most vulnerable part of yourself hits that concrete wall. And so this is the moment in which I start thinking that this might be it. That I actually didn't think I was going to drown. I thought I was going to literally get smashed in the wall. That was what I was thinking. And I did not know how to get myself out of the situation. Our guide was with me, but was struggling just as much as I was, because we were both really just caught up in this like bad scenario. And to make a long story short, we ended up on the rocks in front of the seawall getting like hammered by the surf, which is not better because the rocks were slippery. They were sharp. We're still getting smashed by the waves. I don't know. Like, I can swim okay, but like, this was very quickly way above what I can handle. And I remember thinking, because there's someone else from our group, and I heard her screaming, and I remember thinking, well, I guess I'm doing better than her because I'm not screaming. I'm freaking out, but I'm not screaming. And luckily for us, they had added a lifeguard a month before this beach. So the lifeguard, after she got done helping the girl who was screaming, who was just fine, by the way, actually was probably better off than the guide and I, in point of fact. But the lifeguard realized there was someone else that needed her help. And she came over and she helped me get off the rocks, which involved jumping back in the water, which... let me tell you, that sounds amazing, right? After you've just gotten like washing machine. And so she helped pull me in to shore. And the guy and I were both okay. We were extremely torn up. I was cut all over, bruises. I tore my swimsuit. I lost like pretty much all of our gear. It was quite something. But anyway, so after this whole thing and I'm on the beach and I'm just there, like two things happen in really like succession. So my husband had, he actually didn't know that I was in trouble most of the time. He was, had gone back in, like most of our group didn't realize the guide and I were gone because it's kind of hard to tell where people are in the water. So most of our group went in and they're like, what is going on now? And so I get back on the beach and Austin's like helping me like clean up, like, you know, with the alcohol wipes and rinse off and all that. And he tells me two things in quick succession. One, he says that our neighbor has cancer, like stage 3 cancer. And then the second thing, so I remember thinking that our neighbor is about 40 years old. So I remember thinking, one, that someone that is very, another amazing human in my life has cancer. And then I remember thinking that I also almost just died. And I remember thinking, and I go, fuck, I cannot wait. I remember thinking that I can't wait for traditional publishing. Like, yes, I still want this very much so. But, you know, this idea of like, I'm just going to put my books in the drawer until someone decides they're ready isn't really a thing I want anymore. So I'm still going to pursue traditional publishing, but I will be starting to bring some of my work out. I have one book that's kicking off a series. The book is done and I've been kind of pitching it around. This is the book that the querying has been going really terrible. But I had released like a novelette already on Amazon. You can get it. It's called Empire Song. And then I actually have a couple of short stories that were published in this world. So I had the idea of like, oh, I could also probably pretty quickly do a short story collection. So the general plan, and providing that this book doesn't get picked up between now and like fall, is there'll be a novelette, there'll be a short story collection, and there'll be at least 3 books together. So so some of my stuff is going to start coming out.
Nice.
You know, I'm still
like, that's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. And I have a lot of books that are done that aren't very good that probably should stay in the drawer, but it's more like the books that are done that I think are good that should be out there. And then I have another book that's done that would also kick off a series. And I really think that one will sell traditional in a few years. So my loose plan is just focus on this little project that I'm working on, get all of this done, and then reassess what I'm going to do with that one next. So I figured that's a happy compromise, is like just work on something for a little bit, get all those out, and then, you know, see, okay, maybe I re-query it or something else happens, you know, because that'll probably put me at least like 18 months from now. So who knows?
So it's funny that my experience with Superstars, I had the opposite epiphany. So far, the only thing I have really published, you know, tons of short stories, but I've put like, I don't know, 5 anthologies out, and mm-hmm. the one, that guide of mine that I give away to people that helps them sell their stories.
Which is great.
Yeah, just something fun, trying to use my journalism and combine it with, you know, the writing. When I went to Superstars, I think I went in thinking the only path forward for me was probably indie. And I was completely convinced indie was where I was going to go, because I've been doing
all this. You're talking to me about that too.
Before. Well, no, now I'm going to try trad. I'm going to go trad. This is talking to Jonathan Mayberry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was talking to him and he just sort of told me really try traditional first. And then he sort of was discussing with me the best way to approach that, because I had in Superstars, for our listeners, you can have a career consult, and I happened to have mine with him. And it was freaking phenomenal. I sat down with him and I said, look, for me, it's not about art. And I want the maximum chance for employment income replacement here, because my big life change is I lost the job I had for 28 years right before Superstars. Uh-huh. So it was like, I was shocked, right? Uh-huh. Shocked, a little adrift. This is, you know, don't we all have the dream? I always used to joke I was going to grow up and be Stephen King and write like, you know, strange, dark books and become famous. And then, of course, never have even written a book. So, you know, that dream will not
come true. But you're working on that now.
I am, even though, of course, it's not strange and dark. I'm working on a cowboy romance because, as you know, you and I are both horsewomen and we know mm-hmm. the lifestyle. And I look around at the people around me. I look at my friends, my family, the people I do my sport with. There's not a single one of them who have any interest in reading any horror story that I write. But if I write a cowboy romance, sort of, you know, tapping into the stories around me and our lifestyle, I think they would all read that.
I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, putting a piece of life into art. But one thing I want to say real quick is Jonathan is amazing. That was the first thing I want to say. Second thing is at a different Superstars, I had the VIP dinner with Jonathan, and there was a different writer at our table that I don't think that you know, but her name is Julia V. And she and her writing partner, Ken, and I'm going to murder his last name. So sorry, Ken. But they wrote a book called Ebony Gate, which is out now from Tor, I believe. And the reason the book is sold through Tor is because Julia was talking to Jonathan about the book at the dinner, and he encouraged her to trad pub it, and they sold it a month later. They got picked up. So anyway, I hope that some of this magic will eventually rub off on me.
On both of us.
Yes. Yeah, on both of us. Exactly. But in the meantime, yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely start at the top, work your way down. Is not a bad pathway. And like I said, something I still intend to do. I just am no longer content to put my stuff in the drawer.
No, do door number one and door number two, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You still open both doors. I'm not saying I won't indie pub. I definitely would like to indie pub. And then afterwards I went to LTUE and I sat down and a historical fiction writer. She has a full-time income. She lives in Alaska and she writes historical romance. And she's got a huge following. And, you know, she told me her number. She makes a very decent living at it. Now, mind you, M.A. Nichols is her name. The sweetest woman, 6 feet tall, blonde. I was just very engaged with her in one of the panels and then basically chased her down outside to talk, ask her some questions. And she sat down with me for an hour.
That's nice.
All my questions at a table and was just so lovely. And, you know, she's purely indie. And she's got this sort of great life that she's created where she writes what she wants. She sells it. She's got fans and she makes, a really decent coin doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, there's paths, right?
I have to admit that as I'm contemplating releasing this series in some way, I feel freed by it because I'm unconstrained by a lot of stuff that's been challenging. The first book in the series is called Echo of the Bone Planets. And as long as everything proceeds to plan, that's going to be the title.
It's a great title.
thank you. And, there were some challenges with the series and really telling the story the way that I wanted to tell it. And one of them was I needed a longer word count because it's dual POV. It's science fiction, far future science fiction. I forget what my original, I think it was maybe 120 almost my original starting word count. And I hacked it down to 116, which is better, but I really think the fact that it's that far over 100,000 words is really not helping me out in the querying game. But when I look at the book, I'm if I take any more out, because I am not an overwriter, I'm an underwriter. When I edit, I add words. I take some stuff out, but by and large, my word count grows. And so I feel like if I were to hack out 16,000 words, the book would really lose something. And so I actually feel excited to just be this is the word count that's going to be. And I think that most indie writers can be awesome. Sounds good. Sign me up. What is that? Another 50 pages? And then, you know, just thinking about what I want to do in the future. I'm I can really do anything I want with the series now, can't I?
It's true. It is very freeing. There's definitely that to it, which is funny. That's why when I went to Superstars, I thought I'm definitely indie because I like to do things on my own timeline. I can't imagine waiting 2 years. When I do something, I guess, because I was a television producer, right? I cut the spot in the morning and it's on air in the night. That's immediate gratification. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Journalism, you're right, there's deadlines, it's out. I like seeing the fruits of my labor almost in the next right wave. I love that. I like the I like the short reward cycle, right? And I thought, how am I ever going to manage traditional publishing when it can sometimes be 2 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
But then Jonathan was just like, you know what? Here's what I learned from Gail Carriger too. She was saying, so she is a hybrid author, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting. You can get your books in places traditionally that you cannot get them when you're indie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It gives your books a validity, I guess, right out of the gate.
Visibility,
validity. And no matter what you do, no matter how much work I do, I don't know as much as these agents and these publishers have been doing it for years. I cannot close that learning curve. Mm-hmm. I can do the best that I can. I can study and listen to Joanna Penn and Gail and all these other people who can tell you how to do it. But until you do it yourself, as you know, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. And I mean, I'm sure there's a reason like agents prefer books of like a certain word count, but then there's, you know, there's the business end of a business, and then there's the art end of a business, and then there's the meat in the middle. Like my other business is I do real estate marketing, and it's been about 6 years, actually, this spring. I was thinking about that the other day when I was driving home, is that I'm actually about to cross the threshold into, I have been an entrepreneur longer than I've been someone who had a full-time job.
Oh, wow.
Because I had a full-time job for about 5.5 years. Obviously I've been working longer, but you know, the stuff you do in college and part-time jobs and whatnot, right? So it's not the same. And so I was thinking about that, and that's kind of a significant milestone too. Like, okay, I held it together somehow. But I think about that a lot of like, how I was in the early days and like, you know, in some ways how rigid I was about like, well, this is how you must do a business. And, you know, if the client says this, then you tell them this. And I was thinking about like the actual way that things get done is so much more of a gray area than that. And I'm sure that publishing has the same too. And I feel like when you're going through this gauntlet of the querying, it can be hard, like, cause there's no, you don't have that people interaction, right? Like if I'm typically, when I'm selling something, I typically am talking to someone on the phone almost all the time. I'm talking to them, I'm learning what's important to them, and I'm able to like make a deal with them, you know, craft something for them, like right there on the spot. And sometimes I get it wrong for sure. But a lot of times I'm like, yeah, like if I had listened to people who are like, oh yeah, you never discount your price, you never cut a deal, you always, you know, stick to the same product and you don't ever like vary it, I'm like, I would have missed out on a great client.
Right,
So I kind of feel that way sometimes about publishing, of like, how much are you missing by this really rigid system? And I know they have a lot of volume, but it's something, it's interesting. I think a lot of our industries are in flux for sure and in transition.
That's completely true. So you're going back to Superstars next year.
I am.
Interesting. So I think I'm going to come back as well. So Anne Marie, the little freaking sweetheart, has tapped me to help her with social media.
Oh, nice.
So I think that will be a good way to keep my video production skills going as I...
Oh, right. Did you responded to that like little post?
Yeah. And she said, what do you guys have? And I'm like, well, yeah, I can cut video. So I think...
You'd be great for that. Yeah, I think that would be really awesome if, you know, having all that video content. And I really think, you know, also for yourself too, to keep your video skills up is making, you know, and even just this week, like breaking, we don't know what's going to happen with TikTok, but you know, I think the Facebook, Instagram, YouTube conglomerate is safe. So you can probably at least safely make shorts and book trailers for your own content and put it out there. I mean, I've seen a lot of people get a lot of traction that way. And I think that'd be fun for you to do too, especially if you're doing cowboy romances, because my other book that I'm talking about, so that book, the title is Death Rides in Autumn, is a Western fantasy. And I often think about how much I want that book to be out there, because I want to make trails because yes. It would involve horses.
Yes, of course. That would be so fun.
The title horse in that story is Palomino, because my mom's favorite horse color is Palomino. And so That's what, when I was like, I need a horse. What color should it be? Obviously Palomino. So
Palominos are fantastic, except for keeping them clean. So why don't you do a shout out telling people where they can find you and what you want them to know about you?
Okay. So my website is shannon-fox.com or Isle of Books, which is Isle like island. Isleofbooks.com. My book go to the same place. I'm on social media. I'm pretty much everywhere as Shannon Lynn Fox, which is also my most of my fantasy work is going to be coming out under Shannon Lynn Fox going forward, and sci-fi will be under SL Fox. So that's something that came out of Superstars. So I am in the process of dividing my work across two names, but they're similar enough that hopefully you won't forget. My last name is Fox, like the animal, which is as easy as you can get.
Thank you for hanging in till the very end. And thank you, Shannon, for visiting with us today. If any of you listening would like to learn more about Superstars, I'm going to have a link in the show notes. Remember, until next time, sleep with your lights on. See you on the next episode of Read Me a Nightmare.